Hello, everyone, and welcome to this webinar provided by the ICMA Coaching Program. This is on a very important topic of handling difficult conversations in your organization and beyond. As professionals in local government, there's a great opportunity for each and every one of us to make a difference in how we frame and engage people in our organization, our elected officials, and the community. And there's a crying need for this in an environment where we have such challenges in having good quality conversations that can really get things resolved. So we're thankful that so many of you have joined us today for this session. We have 30 ICMA State Association coaching partners. These are organizations that help us in identifying topics like today's topic and wonderful presenters as we have in this session. And so we're very thankful for their involvement. And we have 10 outreach partners that assist us in reaching a diverse and inclusive audience that's very important for the continued growth and vitality of the profession. We're going to be discussing, you know, what are difficult conversations, what are they like with employees, with elected officials, with citizens and other groups. There are many stakeholders that you interact with. What techniques and skills can you develop to be more effective, and how can you be agile and successful in navigating these very challenging circumstances? So I'm very delighted that we have superb presenters here today. We've got Andrea Arnold, who's a city manager in Decatur. She earned her MPA from the University of Georgia in Athens. She's been on the executive board of ICMA, and she is working very actively with her community, with her organization, and others on handling difficult issues. And she's going to be sharing some specific examples and illustrations for you. We have Pat Martell, who's the ICMA West Coast Regional Director, former city manager, former president of ICMA, and a huge champion of the ICMA coaching program. We're very thankful for all of the ways you've served. And she's going to be sharing her passion, her interests, her perspectives about what's critical to do in having these conversations. And she has an MPA from the University of Southern California. Our third presenter was planned to be Bonnie Sversik, who's the city manager in Lynchburg, Virginia. And unfortunately, Bonnie is handling health issues for her husband and is unable to participate. So I'm stepping in today. I'm going to be kicking off with a discussion about some of the neuroscience insights that are important to consider in handling these types of issues. And then I'm going to be coming on at the end and sharing from my more than two decades of coaching experience with thousands of people around the country and the research I did for my two books, How Great Decisions Get Made and Take Charge of Your Talent, to give you six very concrete, specific coaching tips that you can take and put into practice. So with that said, we're going to be looking at our first polling question here. We'd like to know how we're doing in reaching our audience. We know how many have connected, but we don't know how many are there at the end of each of those connections. So we'd ask you to indicate how many people are participating at your site. We have found over the years that when two or more people gather together and listen and learn from a topic, that it really helps build a critical mass to make change in organizations and to help cultural learning. So I would encourage you to, if you're there on your own today, to be sharing these materials with others so that they can move forward with you and you get the support that you need for handling difficult conversations in your organization and beyond. For those of you that are wondering about the materials, you need to go to the handouts here on the GoToWebinar, or we'll be sending you after today's session the location where they are, and the materials are always available 24 hours in advance of the webinars, and we send that out in the reminder email. If any of you are having any challenges with sound issues, as we noted in the emails, please use the telephone option under audio. That'll give you the best quality. So let's take a look at our audience here today. We see that 84% are there on your own. The remaining are in groups of varying sizes, some up to as many as 20. So we're grateful that all of you have chosen to join us today, and we're excited to have all of you, and thank you for your participation. So let's jump right in to the first set of materials here. What I want to do in this section is to really talk with you a bit about why conversations are difficult. Because if we understand why they are, even right down to the neuroscience level of how our brains work, you'll be more prepared, more able to figure out how you're going to manage those situations as a professional in local government. So let's take a look at some of those key things. Going straight to the neuroscience here, this is a positron emission tomography scan. That's a PET scan, as they're called. That looks at where the brain is working when people are actually dealing with real-life situations. So this is a scan of the brain. The left side here is the front. That's the back. And so this is a vertical cross-section. If you look at the situation here, you'll see that the red area there, when people are fearful, when they're engaged in a difficult conversation, when they're having a challenging circumstance, their amygdala, which is the lizard brain, as it's called, the early reptilian brain, fires up and shoots the adrenaline and the cortisol into our system and gets us all geared up to battle. And that's a self-preservation technique we learn because we have challenges when we're facing in our early ancestors. You know, you're going to fight the tiger, you're going to run away. That's all needed. But in today's challenging environments, that sometimes works against us, because here's what happens to the rest of the brain, and this is what we've learned recently from these neuroscience insights, is that the prefrontal cortex, the part of our brain that's the executive function, actually diminishes in activity. So the purple means that it's far less activity in that area than normal. So just when we need to be thinking through and figuring out how to handle a situation, our ability to do that diminishes unless we take action to respond in a different way. Similarly, cerebral lobes, the parts of our brain that can come up with creative solutions and options for handling a situation, diminish in activity as well. So our pre-wired system, our pre-programmed system for handling challenging circumstances actually betrays us in today's environment. So it means that we really have to be looking at things in a new and different way. And we have to get beyond the fight, the flight, or in some instances in today's environment, just the freeze. So some people in dealing with difficult conversations and so on just sort of freeze up. They don't really engage because it's just so hard and so frustrating. So we want to find a way to get beyond that. And again, the neuroscience helps us understand what that is. This is a scan of a brain when somebody is in a hopeful, positive frame of mind. You'll see that the amygdala here is in green. Green is good. That means it's neither highly activated nor deactivated. It's just in balance and sitting right there and doing its job. But what's very intriguing in all this is what's happening with the rest of the brain. The rest of the brain in a positive, constructive frame of mind is firing up. That prefrontal cortex is giving us the executive function we need to figure out what to do, and the cerebral lobes are kicking in to come up with good and helpful ideas and suggestions. So our jobs as professionals is to figure out how can we get people to have their better brains engaged and in working to help solve issues. So what our presenters and I in turn at the end are going to be doing is talking with you about approaches and techniques that you can make that happen. And that's important for being successful. So I'm going to turn first here to Pat Martell, who's going to share with you her insights. And we're going to be, Andrea and I will be coming back later in the program to share additional insights for you. So Pat, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for all your support for the coaching program. We're eager to hear your insights. And you're on mute. Pat, you're on mute.
Thank you so much, Don. And good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here to talk with all of you this morning about having difficult conversations. You know, there are certain conversations that all leaders dread. The ones that you have to deliver bad news, the ones where you have to discuss a sensitive or political subject, or talk about a project or a meeting that went terribly wrong. And the mere thought of having those difficult conversations often fills you with anxiety and distracts you from other work that you need to be engaged in. You don't want to play the bad cop, or worse yet, have the situation blow up in your face, as it may be, because you don't want to avoid. You don't want to engage in conflict, and you want to avoid the whole mess. But today we're going to talk about some skills that you can develop as a leader that will allow you to tackle those difficult conversations. So why are difficult conversations so important to leadership success? Well, primarily because difficult conversations are all part of life, whether it's at home or at work or out in the community, as you face your day-to-day job responsibilities, there are going to be conflicts that arise that require you to have difficult conversations. Whether it's asking for a promotion or denying someone who has requested a promotion, something that they want, dealing with a frustrating employee or a colleague, even sometimes confronting elected officials or residents. You're going to face those difficult conversations throughout your entire career. So the earlier that you begin to have an understanding of what it takes to deal with difficult conversations effectively, is going to serve you well throughout your career advancement. Difficult conversations are hard for both parties, and that's one of the things we really have to remember. You have to allow people to make choices and decisions, to learn and grow. Having difficult conversations often results in enhancing productivity. It reduces stress. It increases employee morale. So there's a lot of positives that come out of the difficulty of facing difficult conversations. Most importantly, of course, is that managing difficult conversations helps you to build and maintain healthy personal and work relationships, which are so important to any success in life. So at some point, everyone will face a difficult conversation, and you can't avoid it. The longer you wait, the worse it gets. You have to address issues as they come. You have to be confident and direct. You have to start the conversations with confidence. Although, as Don mentioned in his comments earlier, the inclination that we all have at times is to either fight through a difficult issue or conversation that we have. We either fly and don't want to face it at all, or we freeze. And fight, flight, or freeze is not going to help to evolve relationships, to resolve issues that need to be addressed. And most importantly, for you as leaders, to develop the confidence that you need to ensure that you can tackle anything. Whether you initiate the conversation yourself or someone else asks you to have the conversation, the words "we have to talk" always raises anxiety. I know I felt that both on the receiving end of difficult conversations or on the initiating end. And you have to work through the fear that causes you to resist confronting conflictual issues. And sometimes we do that by justifying. We say, well, it's just this behavior or it's just that behavior. But really, all that's doing is trying to create a rationale for us to avoid confronting an issue head on. Conflict is really a natural part of a team environment, and how you handle it determines whether you are contributing to a healthy or destructive environment. Did you know that 70% of employees avoid difficult conversations in the workplace? And that can have a real impact on lowering employee morale and causing a toxic work environment. Additionally, 53% of employees handle toxic situations that they may be engaged with or confront by just ignoring them. And that doesn't help to make progress and to move forward in your organization and in building and maintaining strong relationships. So, what's important about handling difficult conversations? Well, I believe that the most important part is to prepare for the conversation. Going in blindly is going to generally result in very poor results. You need to know what you are doing as you enter into a difficult conversation. You want to ensure that you're walking into the conversation with at least three things that you want to accomplish. And you need to think about that very closely, because going in without having the agenda of what it is that will resolve the issue or conflict, or address the question or need that the person that you're having the difficult conversation with, if you are not clear about what you want the outcome to be, then it's probably not going to be very productive for either side. You want to be able to determine the purpose for having a conversation. What do you want to accomplish? What do you think would be the ideal outcome? And you also want to ensure that you are allowing for the conversation to evolve in a very supportive way with the other party. Whether or not it's a conversation where you're disciplining, or you have to deny someone a promotion, or it may have an overall negative impact on the other party, you want to approach the conversation in a positive way and try and look at what a positive outcome can be. You also want to avoid making assumptions. You really want to listen to the other person's perspective. So if you go in with assumptions, you're not going to be really listening. And open and honest communication in a difficult conversation is essential. You want to really listen more than talk. Even though you will walk in with three reasons why you need to have the conversation and three hopeful outcomes, you want to listen as much as possible to the other person, because that alleviates both your fear and the fear that the other person has. It creates a comfort level in having that difficult conversation. You need to be able to identify what your needs and fears are and listen to the other person, because you will hear through the comments that they make in that conversation what their needs and fears may be. And you have to be realistic about what part you may play in a difficult conversation, a conflict, an issue that has arisen between two parties. We all participate in some manner. And sometimes, as I always say, you know, the truth usually lies somewhere in the middle, where each side has some part in helping to resolve an issue. It's not one-sided. It's not just the other person, or it's not just you who initiates the conversation. Both sides have to work to find some mutual resolution to the problem that you're confronting. Now, all of these things require us to reflect on our own attitudes about the conversation and how it might be influencing the way that we feel about approaching it, and how it may make us feel like we want to run the other way instead of have the conversation. So really taking a personal inventory and thinking about and reflecting what it is you want to accomplish is so important. All of these issues are really reflective of something that's even more important for effective conversations. You have to be authentic, and being authentic requires self-awareness. And self-awareness really requires that you step back and have reflection. And what this all means is that it really does require you to have some high level of emotional intelligence. It's important for you to understand how all of the interactions that you have with others, but particularly during difficult conversations, are really more about your ability to manage relationships. And the higher level your emotional intelligence, the better you are able to deal with those difficult conversations. Our emotional responses to things, both positive and negative, so when we're really upset with someone and we have to have that conversation because they've done something that's made us very upset, made us mad, that emotional response that you have entering a conversation that way is going to affect the topic or conversation that you have. And it's like a domino effect. If you go in upset and you're not aware of what's triggering you about the situation, the issue, what this other person may have done, it's going to just snowball as the conversation proceeds. So reflecting about that, thinking about it, helps you to gain control in a very emotionally intelligent manner to ensure that your conversation has a positive outcome. So there are a variety of strategies that require us to really prepare and to work on making the positive outcomes. And they also dovetail with our ability to demonstrate our emotional intelligence. So difficult conversations occur because people invest a lot in of themselves in situations, and they have a lot at stake. And so you have to really be aware of that before you engage in those difficult conversations. And that's why it's so important to strategically plan for the outcomes that you want in the conversation, and to safeguard against allowing your emotions or your reactions to take over your response in a difficult conversation. So by laying out a strategy, you're able to deal with the various factors that affect emotional intelligence and our ability to work effectively with others. Among the issues that you want to be aware of, as I mentioned previously, self-awareness. You have to understand how your emotions drive you and how that's going to affect the conversation. You've got to self-regulate. You've got to be in control of yourself, and you have to think about that before you go into a difficult conversation, because someone may very easily push a button with you, and you don't want to allow that to affect the way that you respond back to the person in that difficult conversation. So having your strategy in place, knowing your purpose, knowing your intentions for the conversation requires you to focus on enhancing your understanding through effective communication with the other person. Mm-hmm. Not just getting something off your chest or being able to really come down hard on someone for something that may have occurred that is resulting in the difficult conversation, because that really ends up being a one-sided conversation. It's not really a dialogue. And difficult conversations, however hard they are a dialogue between two people. And so you want to identify the shared reasons for having the conversation. You want to resolve the issue, and hopefully the person that you're having the conversation with want to improve the situation and make their life easier. They don't want to make it difficult for you, their boss or their supervisor or their manager. They want to make it easier. They want to be able to focus on the work at hand and not some underlying issue that's making them feel uncomfortable, making you feel uncomfortable, making others within the organization or their colleagues feel uncomfortable. The second thing you want to look at in before you begin engaging in your difficult conversation is the need to really listen actively. And that is really part of being empathic. You want to understand the other person's side. You want to understand how they're feeling about the difficult issue or conflict that you're addressing with them. So really focusing on what's being communicated, both verbally in what you say and also nonverbal signals that you get. So, you know, if a person is really not feeling that you're listening to them, some nonverbal communications can be folding their arms, really cutting off the ability to engage with you. In those situations, you really have to learn how to listen more than talk. And our reactions often, our emotional reactions in a difficult conversation often lead us to want to talk and talk as fast as we can, outline the problem, outline what needs to happen, and try and resolve it quickly. But in doing that and not listening more than talking, we're losing out on the other opportunity that we have to really understand the other party better and to help them to understand where they can meet you in the middle to resolve the issues that you're confronting. You have to take the whole picture into account when you're having these conversations. You also want to stay on message. And that's really important because sometimes in conversations, you can go down and another path. You can digress because another issue is raised in the conversation. when you are leading that difficult conversation, you have the ability to make sure that you stay true to the reasons that you've developed going into the conversation about what you need to resolve, whether it's a person's behavior. So a person is showing up late for work. It's having an impact on team meetings when they're waiting for them. They're not, when they arrive at work late, they're upset and they're not able to focus once they enter meetings. You have your message that you want to deliver. Even though you want to listen, and there may be very realistic reasons why someone is late continually, you don't want to digress in focusing on all those reasons why they're late. You want to bring it back and say, I understand there's family issues. I understand there might have been transportation issues. I understand from what you're saying, what I'm hearing you say is, but then bring it back to the message. But here's the impact that that is having on your behavior here at work, or in whatever setting that the issue is being addressed. So staying on message will allow you to communicate more effectively and avoid letting yourself be derailed by the other person's emotions or reactions or their desire to deflect the real reason why you're having a difficult conversation with them. You also need to ask questions, because a lot of times we enter difficult conversations thinking that we know the causes and we certainly know what the response or resolution to a difficult conversation should be. But we gain a better understanding of another person's point of view when we ask questions. And it's better when we ask open-ended questions. You can draw out a lot of insights about the person and what difficulties they're experiencing, what fears and anxiety they have, whether or not they are angry, which is an underlying reason for causing certain behaviors to occur. So asking why questions and also helps you to avoid defensiveness. It results in defensiveness, and you should try and avoid asking why questions, because that's where you get to talk around and around and around the issue instead of focusing directly on what needs to be addressed and what kind of an outcome you want. You also want to show a great deal of empathy towards the other party that you're having the conversation with, because as I mentioned, emotional intelligence really requires us to have empathy for people, to understand their emotional makeup to the extent that we can, understand how that affects our emotional makeup, and to be able to walk in the other person's shoes, to understand what's causing them to be engaged in whatever the difficult behavior is in the office, whatever difficulty they created in a conversation they had out in the community where they were meeting with a resident and the resident got very upset. Whatever the circumstance are that leads you to have the difficult conversation, you want to demonstrate emotional intelligence and effective communication and putting yourself in the other person's shoes so that you can hear them and focus on how you can help them to turn around the difficulty that you're confronting with the person and they may be confronting with you. You also want to be open-minded. Oftentimes we enter difficult conversations and believe that we have the answer, that we know what's going to be required to resolve the issue. And sometimes through being open-minded and really focusing on the listening instead of the talking in the conversation, we gain insights that help us to have a new outlook on what's contributing to the difficulty between the two parties and how you're going to resolve the issue that you're confronting with the individual that you're having this conversation with. We also have to recognize that everyone has certain rights, and even in difficult conversations, they have a right to be understood. You have a right to be angry or upset or frustrated or emotional about the conversation. And particularly if it's one that you're getting unpleasant feedback, so that you're having to provide unpleasant feedback to the other party. So you have to remember that sometimes the most valuable outcomes in a difficult conversation is just to have both sides be able to express themselves and to be heard. And even if you don't arrive at the successful resolution the first time out in that conversation, you've at least allowed for each side to be heard, to be understood, and to have a voice in that conversation. It's really important in all difficult conversations, whether it's in the workplace or it's at home or it's out in the community, that oftentimes initiating a difficult conversation is not necessarily the end, because sometimes we have to press pause, which is an important strategy in having difficult conversations, because they're very challenging and oftentimes they're very painful to either one or both sides who are engaged in the conversation. So you have to know what your limits are, and you've got to have a plan to press pause if the conversation starts to become too challenging for you or uncomfortable for you or the other person. And that's okay. Pressing pause is okay. If you or the other person that you're having the conversation with are getting angry or feeling hurt in that conversation, you can suggest that you take a minute to take a break, to regroup, and decide whether you want to continue the conversation or take a longer-term break from it. It's all about a process. You have to think of a difficult conversation as a process. It's one in which a single conversation can have a huge impact and resolve an issue, but it can also be a situation where the issue can't be readily resolved, that it's going to take time. And if one conversation doesn't turn out the way you wanted it or the way you planned it out in your mind as you prepared, then think about what you're going to do the next time. What have you learned from this conversation? How are you going to apply it to the next one? And that you can build on the next conversation based on where you leave the conversation when you decide to press pause.
Okay. Very helpful ideas and insights, Pat. So let's go to a polling question here. Pat has identified a whole series of suggested strategies for you. I've put a few of them here into the polling question. I'd like you to tick off as many of the items as you think would be helpful strategies for you to employ in difficult conversations. And while that's happening, I want to go, Pat, to a couple questions that have come in and get your perspective on it. You spoke quite a bit about emotional intelligence and the importance of us as participants in the conversation having emotional intelligence. This questioner is asking, though, what to do in a situation where you're dealing with somebody who lacks emotional intelligence. In other words, they're snarky or they're not, you know, taking your question or your conversation seriously. You know, they're in essence trying to undermine what you're doing. Do you have some suggestions about that? Because oftentimes the people who most need the emotional intelligence are probably the last ones ever to go to an emotional intelligence seminar.
Absolutely. And what I try to emphasize in my remarks is that oftentimes you will be the one who has the emotional intelligence and are trying to apply it in the conversation with this individual. You have to recognize that your job as a leader, whether it's as a manager or a supervisor, is to lead others and to model behavior. So when someone responds in a negative way, your job in the conversation is to take the high road and to apply the emotional intelligence that you have, your self-awareness about what's causing this person to do this. They're feeling like they are guilty of something. They're feeling like they are being disciplined unfairly. What is it? It's your responsibility to try and identify in the course of that conversation what the motivation is there for them to respond in the way that they do. And you have to self-regulate. You can't respond in kind to them. You have to take it back to a respectful level. And you need to tell them that directly. Part of being emotionally intelligent is your ability to be direct with people and to lay out your expectation about the conversation and the behavior that's going to occur and what's not acceptable. And if you are the one who's initiating the conversation and leading it, then you have the ability to set the ground rule. And it takes the more emotionally intelligent leader to be able to identify when you have to put those ground rules in place and when you won't accept certain behavior. And so you can't allow the other person to take over the conversation. And as someone who's emotionally intelligent, can see what's going on, understand the dynamics, have empathy towards people and them feeling defensive and causing them to respond the way that they are. But you have to take the lead on it, and you have to put the ground rules in place.
Great, thank you. We've got a number of other questions that have come in, and we encourage your questions, especially about particular scenarios that you find challenging to deal with. But we want to move on to Andrea Arnold to share with us her perspectives, and then we'll be getting to more and more questions along the way, and some of them will get covered by Andrea, who's going to be talking about some specific illustrations and examples of how to put these practices into play. So, Andrea, thanks so much for being with us today.
All right. Thanks. It's great to be here. Good afternoon. Good morning to some of you out there. And I'm just going to start, if I can find the clicker here. Sorry about that. Just start with a really brief description of my city. Like Don said, I'm in Decatur, Georgia. And we're a small city, about 25,000 people. And we're packed into about 4.5 square miles. We're just outside of the city of Atlanta, about 230 full-time employees. So essentially a very small city, densely populated in a major urban area. And of course, regardless of what kind of community you're in, the strategies and lessons that we're talking about today are going to apply to all types of organizations. And so now that we've heard from Don and Pat about, we've heard a little bit about the science that influences the way we approach these decisions or these conversations. We've heard a little bit about the strategies for engaging in these conversations. I'm going to talk a little more specifically about three scenarios or types of conversations that I personally have had and that I believe that you all are likely to experience if you haven't already. And you'll see that it builds on Pat's advice, and you're gonna hear a lot of similarity in some of the same points. But specifically, we're gonna be talking about conversations with what I consider professional management level employees, conversations with elected officials, as well as conversations, difficult conversations with our residents.
Do is find out as Andrea and the rest of us speak to these different topics, is which kinds of conversations are most interesting and challenging to you as our audience. So take a moment to click off as many, maybe all of them are. And we certainly, again, welcome you to use the question function to enter and type in any questions or circumstances that you find especially challenging. We'll address them anonymously, so we welcome your candor. But take a moment to help us identify where you would especially like to have our presentations focus for your help and assistance today. Just while you're doing that, audience, I want to turn to you, Andrea, and what do you find for your own personal experience is the most challenging arena, either in terms of the frequency with which it's a challenge or the intensity of it?
I was just thinking about that. I was thinking that the one that's the most challenging is always the one that's right in front of me. You know, it really depends. But to be quite honest, it's the one with the elected officials. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in the presentation, but that's probably my biggest challenge area.
Okay. Well, certainly every one of the areas that you identified were found to be a significant challenge to our audience, but people are especially interested in dealing with employees in their own organizations. So let's take that in mind and go forward with your presentation.
Okay, so we're going to talk about having that conversation with the professional management level employee. And just as a reminder here is that you are the role model, whether you're the city manager, an assistant city manager, a department head, people are paying attention to what gets addressed. And I believe, you know, Pat had referenced an employee coming in late. You know, I mean, everyone else, the other employees see it when their coworker is regularly coming in late. And if that's something that, say you as the supervisor, if you're not addressing, then you're sending a message about what is or is not important to you and to the organization. Also, just remember that you set the tone, you control the tone of the conversation, even if to the point of, you know, the person that asked the question about what do you do when you're dealing with somebody who may not have a very high EQ, and they are trying to, you know, hijack the conversation, you continue, your responsibility is to control that tone of the conversation. And that's, you know, not just with your voice, but also quite often with you know, facial expressions and your body language as well. And also to Pat's point, just the importance of being prepared. And being prepared, using these strategies, then that's going to influence the effectiveness and the overall outcome of these conversations. So let's talk about a real example. This is one of the hardest conversations that I've ever had, and would likely be one that that I think that you could appreciate. And if you haven't had, I promise you will have to have this conversation. In this case, it's telling a very smart, a very dedicated employee that they didn't receive the promotion that they applied for, that they were very hopeful about. And it's my responsibility to provide that upsetting news to them. You know, and I asked myself, you know, why was this so hard? And first and foremost, I just didn't want to hurt this person's feelings. That's quite often that's what this comes down to, is these are people that we know, we have relationships with, we've worked with them for years, we care about them. We know that they're going to be so disappointed. But, you know, beyond that, I was also concerned that that he was going to be angry, possibly resentful of me, and that this was going to play out in his work performance. And also, I didn't know what the future was going to look like after having this conversation. I worried, would we be able to move through this issue? And also, you know, we had a very collegial working relationship. What was going to happen to that? Was this going to put a strain on that working relationship? So let's talk about how I handled this. And again, you're going to see a number of the points that Pat made also reiterated here. You know, first of all, this was a conversation that I had in person. And that should be needless to say, but I think in this day and age, I continue to be shocked at the type of information that gets communicated by email or by text or over the phone. These types of conversations have to happen in person, face to face. The conversation that I took on and had myself did not include HR. That's my advice, is not to slough off the hard conversations on your HR director, HR manager. Although I will say that your HR director is someone that you may want to speak to in advance of having these types of conversations for a little bit of guidance there. And I knew that this was going to be hard. This is the empathy part, just knowing that this was going to be hard for him to hear. And knowing that, I was trying to convey that understanding through my tone, through my words. But I have to say, the hard part for me was sticking to the message and staying focused. And quite honestly, you just want to spit out the bad news and then try to hide it or cover it up with positives or promises of some future opportunities. And don't do that. You just have to stay focused on the message and also allow for the uncomfortable silence. But I think our natural inclination, though, is to, again, spit out the news that's hard to share and then immediately just try to almost cover up the bad message with flowery language or trying to make some promises of well, how things can be different, how things can be better. And that is completely unnecessary, and I think in some ways it's insulting to the person who's receiving the message. And I believe that this was a point that Pat had made, that this conversation, the hard conversation, is very much the first step. For us, I relayed the information, was empathetic, and then, again, allowed for some time, quiet time for him to digest the information, to ask some questions. And then at that point, we made a commitment, or I committed, to speaking to him at a later time after he had time to think about it. And then we could go into, what happens next. And that was where we were able to talk about, what kind of professional development, what other experiences, work experiences did he need to have. But again, that first meeting wasn't the time for that conversation. And but again, it really is that first, this conversation is very much the first step. And but you will be judged by what happens after that conversation. You have a responsibility to follow up, to follow through. And like I said, in this case, we made a commitment to talk about professional development, and that was done. But always stay true to your organization's values. Your values also should guide you in how you treat each other. You're going to be honest with each other. You're going to respect each other. And you're going to act with integrity. And so just always have those organizational values to fall back on. And so if the conversations with the employees aren't difficult enough, I'm going to move on to this group of people that make our jobs very rewarding and challenging. Quite often at the same time, and these are our elected officials. And one thing that I didn't say earlier, or I don't think was communicated, is that I'm 11 months into the role as a city manager, and so the relationship with an elected body is a new skill set that I'm building. So I'm still maneuvering, I'm still learning in this area. To Don's point, I would say that this is the area that I find for myself is one of the biggest challenges. The folks that you see here, though, in front of you, this is my dream team. This is my city commission, an amazing group of people. but with whom I still find certain conversations really difficult. And I ask myself, you know, what is it that's so hard about speaking with this group individually or as a group and relaying information that again, they may not want to hear? And I realize that you know, personally, I just want harmony with this group. I want us to get along. I don't want there to be discontent. Within this body, I feel like I have a responsibility for promoting harmony within the group. And is it okay that I admit that there is some worry about job security? I mean, I know that these are the people that make a decision about me being in this role, and I think we just have to admit that is something that's going to be on our mind. If we are saying something to them, we have a responsibility to tell them things they may not want to hear. But there is that concern of what kind of backlash or pushback you may get from them. And for me, it's just plain awkward as well, because it feels like a role reversal in the sense that these are the people that I work for. These are my five bosses. And but I'm in a position where I may be, telling them something that they may not be really eager to hear. So we're going to go into one example that I've had during the course of this year with the elected officials. And this is specifically an elected official addressing negative comments that are out there on social media, negative comments about the city on social media. And we do not have enough time today to talk about the negative influence that some social media is having in our communities. But I'm going to make an assumption that we are sharing similar issues within our communities of angry and misinformed residents that are lashing out at the city or the county on Facebook or Nextdoor or other social media platforms, which is not something new, but in this case, we had a commissioner engage with a commenter on social media. And this, it was relatively benign, but I felt very strongly that this wasn't an activity that I wanted or an approach from the city commissioner that I wanted to see become the norm. And so that's, I may not have this listed here, but you know, my advice is when something pops up, address it, you know, address it soon, address it early, don't let it linger. So I knew I needed to take action. And then I did ask myself, you know, is this something that I need to involve the mayor or you know, would you need to involve the chair of your board? And I decided that you know, in this case, it didn't rise to that, but definitely a consideration sometimes. The mayor may be able to have a conversation that you can't have. We met in person. We already had a meeting set up. And was able to take advantage of that time with the commissioner to express my concern and explain, to Pat's point, just being prepared and being able to explain, you know, why is it that it matters? And in this case, it was we don't want to legitimize the person in this. On social media, and we also didn't want to make it appear it was a city platform or a public platform where people could come and expect any number of complaints could be posed and that they would be able to expect a response from a city commissioner or a city employee. We didn't want to create that expectation. At the same time, I offered a solution that, you know, the city was going to, would develop a platform to tell our story. So if there was misinformation about our recycling program, for example, then we would use the city's news outlets to talk about the recycling program. And of course, I was prepared for the pushback that I really didn't get. I think that the worry about the conversation was a whole lot worse than the conversation itself. But I was willing to listen to an alternative solution. You know, the commissioner actually suggested creating what we're going to be referring to as a MythBusters site, where there's misinformation out there in other venues, that people could go to this MythBusters site and get the city's side of the story. And of course, this is just a first of many conversations about this, and so we have had time to talk about this since the initial conversation. And in order to be successful with these types of conversations, the respect has to be in place to begin with, in between the staff and the elected body, that I know that we have a shared vision and that we do have a strong and sound relationship to build upon. And finally, the people that we serve every day, our residents. We interact with our residents on a daily basis, and for the most part, these should be relatively positive relationships and interactions that we're having, but sometimes we have to communicate things to the public, to specific residents that they just don't want to hear. Personally, I worry about the volatility of the conversation. quite often, you just don't know if this is the last straw for somebody. I think that's been my experience. Something that seems relatively benign just pushes somebody a little bit over the edge. They have other issues, other challenges going on in their lives, and this is what has set them off. I also have a concern about how they're going to retaliate on social media. And you know, you are the messenger. You know, you're not always the advocate or the creator of that message, but nonetheless, it is your responsibility to communicate the message. And just, we always have to remember that you cannot, quite often, you can't make them happy. A decision is already made. There may not be an alternative that's going to satisfy them. So right now, you see this photo that's there in front of you. That's just a really bizarrely designed intersection over a railroad track. And we now have a plan that's going to completely change this intersection to improve safety, especially for pedestrians, for bicyclists. But it is going to take the right-of-way, in particular, in one resident's front yard. And we have met in person, again, having these meetings in person. In this case, we went to them. That's also an important thing to think about, meeting people where they are, you know, going to their property, seeing where they live, and really seeing what it is that's concerning them or upsetting them. And we've listened a lot, and I think that's, you know, that's also key, is just someone, even if they know that the decision has been made, at the end of the day, they want to know that they have been listened to. And we went into this, you know, understanding the emotions that are in play. I mean, it's right away, but I mean, I call it right away, they call it their front yard, and we have to empathize with them. And we've spent a lot of time talking about the public process, and that discussion has been very helpful where they know that the decision hasn't been made in a vacuum, but there has been an extensive public process that has gotten us to this point. And I would say our main focus has been how the decision is about an improvement that's for the whole community, that we understand that this is, you know, one person, this is their property, it's very important to them, that property is going to be impacted, but this is going to be for the greater good of the community. And it's also, it's consistent with the city's vision, with our strategic plan, you know, specifically about the city's priorities for bicycle and pedestrian safety. And yes, it's okay to agree, to say, absolutely, we understand. If I was in the same situation, I would be frustrated as well. However, we know that we can't make promises that the plan's going to change, you know, decisions have been made, but also there's the possibility, in light of that, the possibility to be open-minded and understand that, that maybe there's some ways that we can minimize the impact. But ultimately, they need to know that you care and that you've taken the time to listen to them. And then finally, just, you know, what do all these examples have in common? And they're very similar to what you heard from Pat. You know, it's humanizing the conversation, going into it, understanding, trying to understand how the message is going to be received, and then just being so prepared, so focused, knowing exactly what it is that you're trying to achieve, and to be completely clear. And as I said earlier, just to say what you have to say, and then basically shut up and not say too much. Also, perspective, the big picture is important. Kind of like, this is what's best for the organization. This is what's best for the community. And again, it's the first step. Do what you say you're going to do. You're going to follow up. You're going to have more conversations. There'll be more action from this. And also, I encourage, this is not something that you have to do alone, and find other people that you trust and seek advice from before having these hard conversations.
Okay, we're going to go to a polling question. You've heard a lot of good, helpful ideas and lessons and suggestions from Andrea, and we want to see which ones are particularly resonating for you. And so if you'll take a moment to tick off as many of these as you think would be relevant to apply in your handling of difficult conversations, that'll be great. It gives a good opportunity for you to reinforce in your own thinking the things that you've been hearing from Andrea. While this is going on, I want to cover a number of questions that have come up. There's a question of how do you handle and address topics of ethics? I want to highlight to people that we did have earlier this year on April 10th a session just on ethics in action and the challenges of how to raise ethical issues, deal with them, address ethical issues with your boss or with your elected officials. And so I'd really refer you to that particular one. And we're also getting a lot of interest about social media. I think many agencies are finding challenges with social media. And again, if you go to the agendas and archives for the ICMA coaching program webinars, you'll see a webinar that we had specifically on the topic of social media that went into these issues a lot more deeply. So encourage you to take advantage of some of those opportunities and resources that will help answer some questions that you have about specific difficult areas of interest. Let's take a look and see how the issues resonated for our audience here. We can see the big ones were around the preparation, focus, and clarity, but all of them were strategies and lessons that people found were extremely helpful. So I want to thank you, Andrea, for your great presentation on that topic. And I do want to make a comment here about Andrea's webcam and our internet connection today. When we practiced this, it was great. Today it's appearing somewhat pixelated, so I wanted you to know that Andrea is in good health, has a great appearance, and that it's just the internet today that somehow with the connection is betraying her good looks. So thanks, Andrea. Let's go forward here. And so what I want to do is to share with you, because one of the things I found in the whole topic of how to handle these difficult conversations is, again, thinking back to the neuroscience. And this is what has really driven my thinking about it, is that in the neuroscience, we know what happens with our brains if people are in a fearful or combative or anxious state, and how we need to get them out of it. And what we've also know is that it only takes like a fraction of a second. And again, this is sort of an adaptive thing that we have to respond in that defensive, fearful, combative way. Because obviously, you know, if we were having to fight a tiger or to flee away from a tiger, we don't have all day to think about what we're going to do. We just have to jump into a reaction. But again, in today's environment, with these kinds of issues that you're raising with your questions and everything else, we have to respond much more quickly and agilely, but we have time to think them through. And so the issue is, how can we go about creating an environment? How can we follow some practices that enable us to overcome these default settings, if you will, that we have with regard to our reactions to situations? And in order to do that, we have to be very conscious and intentional, because it's so easy, even if we have the best intentions at the start of the conversation, for somebody to draw in our lizard brain, somebody to say something that prompts us, even though we wanted to be positive and constructive, and draw us into something that is negative and combative. And I think we've all seen the results of that and the frustration that it comes about from it. So let's take a look at some things that you can do. First point I want to highlight is that productive processes overcome challenging personalities in politics. So if you see that you're having a lot of personality conflicts, a lot of political conflicts, look to processes that are going to help you to overcome that. You've heard some from Pat and Andrea about the practices that they follow. I'm going to be covering some things that are stepwise things that you can do to address them. And these practical steps are going to enable you to bring forth the best in yourself and others, enable you to get that better brain working for you and working for the other person. And it has to work for both of you, because you can't just come to it and say, okay, I'm going to be positive and constructive. But if something's happening in that conversation, or you're doing something that triggers unintentionally the combative, negative, fearful reactions of the other person, it's not going to work. You're not going to have a productive conversation. So what can you do? You've heard over and over about planning your conversations and practicing. I want to give you a structure that I found with the executives and teams that I coach all over the world has been very, very effective. And there's resources about this so that you can encourage this hopeful mindset, not only for yourself, but sustain it with the other person. So you can address anything with anybody else if you do it in the right way. And here's a framework that I found to be very effective. The first is to be clear in your intention with the other person, and to have a bridge between what's of interest to you and what's of interest to them. So, for example, in the situation where you're delivering, having to have a difficult conversation with an employee, which is what you overwhelmingly were interested in today, it would be indicating, okay, I want to talk with you about, you know, how this our work situation can work effectively for our organization and for me and for you. And so that everybody sees a way that they can win out of it. And then you're very intentionally creating that bridge with the other person. Then to provide observations, to be very factual. It's very interesting, you know, what we can say in ourselves might be fighting words to somebody else. So the whole idea here is to think of yourself like a scientist. You're just providing data. Here's what I'm observing. You're not putting a judgment or a label on the observation of the behavior. You're just stating what it is. This really helps people to hear it and to see that they're not being judged as a person, but you're observing behavior and you're observing the impact of behaviors on the objectives that you have for the organization or what's occurring. And then make a request. Have it be simple, direct, and go quiet after making it. So the person has something very concrete to respond to, rather than a sort of an amorphous set of observations, but with nothing that's crystallizing into a particular request. And then once you've had the conversation about it, confirm what you've come up with. It's amazing how often people come away from the same conversation with dramatically different reactions to it. And you need to confirm what you've agreed to and what's going to happen next and where you are in the situation. Otherwise, you'll have a very disjointed and unproductive conversation. There's a specific worksheet that's in your agenda packet that describes this process and gives you a worksheet to fill in. And what I encourage you to do is to practice with a friend or a coworker to confirm that you aren't likely to trigger a negative response in the other person. Ask them, hey, here's what this other person is like. Put yourself in their shoes and tell me if how I'm approaching this is going to be engaging to them and what you think the response would be. You know, I'm struck for myself, you know, how often after a difficult conversation, I will replay that difficult conversation in my mind over and over and over. So it's really worthwhile to invest up front in practicing the conversation. Because if you practice the conversation and you have some feedback and you know how it's going to go and what's going to happen, or at least you've got some ideas about it from having practiced it with somebody else, you'll be better prepared and you'll have fewer repetitions of that frustrating conversation in your mind afterwards by preparing once up front. So take advantage of those resources. You've heard over and over about the importance of really doing these conversations in person. There's a cascade of approaches, and it really makes sense to do these in person first, conversation over the phone if you can't be in person. Email is, I've never seen a case where email has solved a relationship issue or a tough circumstance, because the information you convey to somebody else without the presence that you have to give nuance and tone and reaction and reading of the other person, maybe fighting words to them, and certainly text messages are even worse. So you got to manage and figure out, you know, what your approach is going to be so that you can really be engaging with the other person and do it in a way that you're getting that more relaxed, engaged, positive thinking rather than the lizard brain that might just pop off and then you get another email back that's angrily, you know, defending what they inferred you were asserting about them, et cetera, et cetera. So that's important. You heard from others the importance of dealing with this very in a timely way. I provide as a guidance to the people that I coach the suggestion that don't let the sun set before you deal with a difficult conversation. People will, and I find it for myself and everyone that I coach, if you let it slide, the frustration builds. The opportunity to have a discussion about the behavior that was a problem or whatever gets more distant. People start to react and say, well, why didn't you bring this up earlier? Or, gosh, I don't remember it that way. So be sure you're trying to, even if you can't have the conversation in the same day before the sun sets, you know, highlight to the person, again, using that intention observation request approach of, you know, I'm concerned about this issue and about how we can work together to address it in a way that it'll be effective for you as the elected official and for our organization as a whole. I'm noticing that there's a lot of traffic happening with the social media. Can we talk about this, get together and talk about this, you know, tomorrow or the next day or sometime that's convenient for you, so that we can be sure that we're all on the same page here and that it's working effectively for you and for our community. So that would be a way to even use the request in the request to have a conversation. So the person has a choice about if and when and how they're going to engage, so that you know and they feel comfortable in what's coming forward. And you've put sort of a marker on the topic so that they're not continuing to behave in a way that's going to cause challenges. And they know that there's something at play here that needs to be addressed. So key thing, how do we avoid triggering this lizard brain in ourselves when somebody approaches us, a disgruntled constituent or an angry employee who's saying, you know, why aren't you dealing with this? Or what are you, you know, how come you're not handling this? And they probably even use very judgmental words, which you know from the neuroscience are going to trigger your lizard brain. So you have a fraction of a moment when a situation like that confronts you, to make take some action that is going to be able to flip you from being inevitably drawn into that lizard brain thinking and being at a loss then to use your best faculties, or to get into your better brain thinking and to keep it going for you and for the other person. So you need to avoid letting that lizard brain get hooked. You need to listen to understand before you respond, and to use generous reflective listening. And Pat and Andrea have both talked about that. I want to give you a very specific tool, though, of how I found it really, really works very effectively to do that. Because, again, we only have a fraction of a second to get this right before things get out of control. And that is for you to think of yourself in that situation when you're confronted with that difficult conversation, or somebody comes, you know, you've had the, you're setting up the conversation that you've initiated, but then they come back in your face and say, well, you know, if you weren't such an ineffective manager, I would be able to handle all this, but, you know, you're not doing your job. And then you say, whoa, they're kind of getting into your lizard brain then, because somehow they got tapped into theirs. So think of yourself as a mirror. So the first job in any one of these conversations is to reflect back what you're hearing. So, you know, in a situation like that, you would say, gosh, I'm hearing that you're feeling very angry about this situation, and that you really are concerned about what role and responsibility other people have in that for how you're handling your own behavior here. So it's not judging, it's just observing, it's just reflecting back, it's giving the person a mirror. Now, what that mirror does is give them a chance to say, well, you know, that's not exactly what I meant, but, you know, I'm just really angry about this because I've tried hard and I haven't been able to figure it out. So you give the person a chance to kind of back down on their own by being a mirror to help them see themselves, because oftentimes people will get unhinged because their lizard brain is kicking in and they're not seeing themselves, even in their own behavior. They're not aware of what's happening for them in the situation. So very important to think of yourself as a mirror. And that also gives you a moment before you absorb all this and before you become a sponge. And sponges get dirty and grimy because they've absorbed so much. Instead of becoming a sponge and absorbing all this, you're giving yourself the chance to you know, give yourself a moment to take a breath, to refocus yourself, and to make sure that you're able to understand, hear, and move forward effectively with what's really on the table versus what has gotten your lizard brain hooked into the particular dynamics. So a third thing here is to redirect aggressive energy. A lot of things come up in the fight, flight, or freeze, and oftentimes people come to the conversation already in that state of fight, flight, or freeze. And so they want to engage with you. They want to rumble. They want to make you back down. They want to make you move. They want to make something happen because they've got all that adrenaline in their system, and they're fired up and ready to cook. You know, we can try different approaches on how we deal with that. Sometimes people will approach that by engaging with the person and push it back and will say, hey, no, you're out of line here. This doesn't really work. Well, of course, the person's then going to push back and say, no, I'm not out of line. This is my role. I can say what I want to say. You know, and then you're back and forth. What I found effective in this is I'm very fascinated by Aikido. It's a martial art. And the martial art of Aikido, and I don't practice it myself, but I've observed it, and I'm really struck by how effective it is physically. And the martial art of Aikido is the one of taking that aggressive energy and then redirecting it in an effective way. So that rather than fighting with the person, you know, in their face, back and forth, you say, okay, I hear that you're feeling very frustrated about, you know, your work situation, and that you're really wanting something to change here dramatically. Let's go together and look at what the circumstances are that you're particularly concerned about. So you see, it's actually kind of taking that energy and moving it forward and off in a constructive direction versus saying, well, I don't think this is a bad situation, or, you know, I don't agree with you, or whatever else, all of which isn't going to relieve that lizard brain adrenaline and cortisol is, you know, dousing the person's system with that aggressive behavior and action and reaction. So there's some simple things you can do to try these things out and to make them work. Another thing that I found extraordinarily useful is that it's very helpful to give people choices. People don't want to be corralled or railroaded into a direction. Oftentimes, people who are very directive in their style will be pushing you in particular directions. And the best way is to offer them choices that help fulfill the hopes that you share about the particular situation. So you might, someone might come to you and say, well, you know, doggone it, we got to have a stop sign in the corner of 5th and Arcade because, you know, there's, you know, challenges there, and we not only need a stop sign, but we ought to have a stoplight. And you could sort of push back at them and say, okay, you know, no, or we've studied that, or we've done it, whatever. But you could offer them some choices and then help them choose amongst them. Well, you say, you know, in our traffic plan, we have several ways of dealing with difficult circumstances. We look at the incidence of interactions at that location. We look at a choice of different options that we have, from lighting to stop signs to traffic calming to other approaches. You know, let's take a look. And the whole idea is that you present a set of choices, and then the key here, and I think of this about our daughter when she was growing up, you know, it never worked for our daughter, who was very headstrong, to tell her, you know, here are the vegetables tonight, it's broccoli, and you got to eat it. It always worked better if I said, okay, which would you like to have, peas, carrots, or broccoli? She had the opportunity to make a choice, and it was then her choice, and we weren't fighting about, is she going to eat her vegetables tonight? She was choosing which one she was going to have. So there's a lot of ways that you can help in structuring your engagements with your employees, with your elected officials, with members of your community, to give choices. And I think that's a high level of opportunity for local government professionals, is, you know, to lay out options. And if you're laying out options that you think can work, you know, don't lay out options that are unreasonable or inappropriate or contrary to your policies, but often there are choices. If you can lay out choices and say, hey, you know, basically we could be good with any of these, and there are pros and cons on them, and you let your elected officials or with the involvement of your residents engage around those choices, you'll find that you'll have much happier people. The same thing with anything you're trying to deal with your employees. You say, well, you know, what options do you see here? Is there another way you think this could happen to get what needs to be accomplished here done effectively? Then you're inviting that better brain thinking, that executive function. You're pulling that back in. You're engaging their cerebral lobes. They're not just this fight, flight, or freeze engagement on the lizard brain. So lots of things you can do. And as, you know, Pat and Andrea suggested, you know, hey, if you've lost somebody to their lizard brain, you know, in other words, if so much adrenaline has shot down through their system and cortisol that literally, you know, they're not available, at least not at their higher functioning, then it's time to regroup, recalibrate, reengage. And trying to push because, oh, we got the meeting tonight, this is when we said it, you know, it's got to happen. Don't get yourself boxed in a corner. Give yourself a chance to take a look at how you can approach things differently. And then on the theme of, you know, how healthy processes overcome personalities and politics, a number of you have sent in situations where, like some of you are working this fall on community conversations. How you do that is going to be really important, how you can be an actor in that situation rather than a victim of the circumstances. In other words, you're just some local government professionals, I find, you know, they just sort of set up the public hearing and then they just kind of try to survive whatever happens. Well, you can do much more by directing and guiding the processes that are followed to make that a constructive session versus, oh my God, I think I'm just going to live through this and, you know, go home and kind of try to sleep it off. And especially if you're a leader in a tough conversation, you know, use hopeful, constructive processes, because at each step in your discussion and engagement of the community, you're working to keep that better thinking intact. And it's so easy for it to flip in a moment with somebody's comment, with somebody's reaction, and for the whole thing to spiral out of control. And you can be a guerrilla agent in these environments. So you don't have to be the one controlling a particular situation to make a difference. And I wrote the book, How Great Decisions Get Made, and you've got a quick start guide in your agenda packet. The agenda packet is there in the handouts. It has all these resources in it, and you can take advantage of it. So I encourage you to make use of the resources and find ways that you can put them into play. And I've tried to make as many of them as available as possible. I included video clips and handouts that are free of charge on the icma.org/coaching website under talent development, and many other resources that are available there, all for your access and use. So I want to get to a quick polling question here, and then we're going to cover some additional questions that came up from you, our audience, and have our close here today. But which of these coaching tips might you like to put into practice? And while that's happening, I'd like to cover some of the other questions that have come up. So I'm going to be drawing Pat and Andrea back in on their webcams and on their phone lines. So we'll be covering a few of those as they come along here. One of the things that was particularly interesting, Pat and Andrea, on the questions that have been coming in is people wondering, you know, how do you have a tough conversation with your boss? In other words, is something that you think you need to bring to the attention of your boss? Most of our conversation has been how to have it with the employee, assuming somebody that's reporting to you. What are a couple quick thoughts that you have, and very quick in our limited time here, maybe Pat and then Andrea, about how to have the conversation, how to initiate that with you? How would you want an employee of yours to approach you that would help engage you in a constructive way on a difficult topic?
So I think what often happens is that people are afraid to approach their boss, but that difficult conversation should really be no different, Don, than any other conversation. I think you want to keep the conversation positive. So whatever it is that you're approaching the boss about, you want to keep it on a positive level. If you have an idea about something that you feel has been overlooked, if you feel like there's a request that you've made, whether for a promotion or a salary increase, and you don't feel all the facts have been provided, remember, you want to keep it objective, not subjective, and just because you think you deserve it, but you want to be objective. So keep the conversation on a positive level and don't focus on negative issues about others involved. You've got your boss's attention. Focus on results. Tell your boss that if you were able to address the issue that you are raising with her or him, that you would be able to deliver X results as a, that would be the outcome, and that there would be a win for both the organization as well as you. And in the end, if the decision, the final decision that your boss makes about the issue that you are broaching, is not what you're hoping for, respect the final decision, because that will generate respect on the part of your boss. And maybe the next time you have one of those difficult conversations, you will get a more positive outcome. The decision will fall in your favor. But it's all about being positive, focusing on results, I think, and also respecting what the ultimate decisions are.
Okay. Let's move, in the interest of time here, Andrea, to another topic. And Pat, we're inviting you back on your webcam if you can draw us back in there. That's great. And Andrea, glad to see that your webcam image is properly reflecting you now. So another question is, and this came up from several people, do you have any advice for delivering bad news that you may not agree with yourself, but is a decision that others have made? A quick thought about that.
Well, I guess my first thought is, even if it's something that you don't necessarily agree with, again, you're in the position of being the messenger. You have to own the message. You have to own the responsibility of that message. And I think that's the same advice I would give to an employee also going to their boss, is don't bring other people into it. It's not about hearsay or somebody else, but again, you, whether you're delivering bad news or trying to talk to your boss, it's you're taking full responsibility for that message.
Okay, great. Great. And we have a poll up now because we're eager to have you sort of reinforce your learning from today for yourself, as well as some feedback for our presenters on what you would like to take away as value from today's session for yourself or for your agency. And again, I'm getting many questions from people about wanting to have this information and share it with their organizations. And again, you will have the digital recording and the whole PowerPoint presentations, et cetera, available in the agenda and archives. And everyone who registered for today's session will be receiving that in an email within the next 24 hours. So all this is going to be available to you. And let's take a look at the polling results here. Sharing those. So we see people got a value out of it in many dimensions. Glad the coaching tips were helpful, but certainly the examples and illustrations and the frameworks that Pat and Andrea were sharing with you were very valuable, and we appreciate everybody's participation in the session. So let's just cover a couple final things here. We have contacts for today, so a number of you have questions that weren't really fully addressed in today's session. I encourage you to reach out to us if you have questions or concerns. I'd like to be of help to you and supportive in your success in this profession. I do want to highlight finally here, thank you for learning and growing in service to your communities. As some of you know, I informed ICMA over a year ago that I'd be concluding my work as director of the ICMA coaching program this December. It's time for me to create a new chapter in my talent story with service to other important social issues. So I want to give special thanks to ICMA, its leaders and staff, all of the volunteer presenters like our wonderful presenters today, and the volunteer coaches that help us in serving people throughout the profession, and especially to Frank Bennis, who's championed the ICMA coaching program from when we began 16 years ago with just a handful of attendees through to the present when we're serving over 6,000 attendees each year. ICMA is committed to continuing the coaching program and is making arrangements for the program in 2020 and beyond. So I'm going to be eager to see how you and the ICMA coaching program work together to continue to innovate and evolve the services. In closing, I'm deeply grateful to you, our audience, for your careers of service to your communities. Best wishes to all of you. Thank you so much for all you do to make our local communities the special places to live that we're able to enjoy. Thanks, and have a great day.
Thank you, Don, for all of your service and dedication. It's been greatly appreciated.
Thank you. Appreciate all your leadership and support. And Andrea and Pat, thanks for doing a great job today. Really appreciate you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Pleasure as well.